Good evening, race junkies. I'm Trish England, and welcome to Race Talk with Trish, produced by Dave Wallen and the Racing History Project. All our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website. And there's a lot of background noise. www.racinghistoryproject.com, also on www.archive.org, and now on iHeartRadio, Spotify, and Amazon. Our live audience numbers are impressive, but the number of downloads from the archive library is mind-boggling. Check out the Racing History Project website to see what you've missed. Tonight, we're proud to welcome a trio of IMSA's VIPs. John Doonan, the president of IMSA, Beau Barfield, the race director of IMSA WeatherTech and the Michelin Pilot Championships, and Mark Raffoff, senior director of race operations. Let's have a round of applause. Yay! Each one of these gentlemen became immersed in racing at an early age following their father's SCCA and club racing excursions. They each raced their own cars for a while before becoming inspired by the business and administration of motorsports. John Doonan fell in love with Mazdas, specifically the new 79 RX-7 first gens, and he went to work for the company right out of college. He moved up to Mazda North America in 2004 as the motorsports team development, creating racing opportunities for Mazda drivers all over the country. And in 2011, up to director of Mazda Motorsports, where he spearheaded the successful Yost DPI team and the Mazda Road to 24 program. In 2019, John was tagged by Ed Bennett and Jim France to succeed Scott Atherton after his retirement as president of IMSA. This move surprised no one. Everybody in the paddock knew and respected John, so it was just a natural transition. Beau Barfield started racing as a kid in 89 and spent the next 17 years alternating between driving every kind of car he could find with regular stints as a racing instructor. Then he was ready to start running things. From 2002, he was chief steward for several sanctioning bodies, including Champ Car and its associated series, Formula BMW, Trans Am, and Formula Atlantic. In 2006, he segued into IMSA as race director for GT3 Cup, then as race director for ALMS. He spent 2 years in that position as IndyCar before returning to IMSA for good in 2014. Beau imported some useful methods and strong philosophies from IndyCar, which have served IMSA very well. You'll know it when you see him at the track for his unique mode of transportation, a two-wheeled, self-balancing electric scooter. Look, Ma, no hands. Okay, Mark Raffoff is the senior member of this trio. He started working for John Bishop at the age of 16 and rose up to the ladder to VP of IMSA alongside John. He weathered the ups and downs, divisions, and reformations that IMSA has endured. Throughout those years, he covered many roles related to general management, technical regulation development and enforcement, events, and racing operations. All of the associated series within IMSA's sanctioning body have Mark's hand in inception, operating, and expansion. He's done it all, and he still is. He's the current USA delegate to the FIA, among other prestigious international positions. And somehow along the way, he found the time to co-author with Mitch Bishop the ultimate IMSA reference book, IMSA, 1969 to 1989. So, audience, please mute your phones. If you have a question, just send it via chat, and our producer will pass it along. Ta-da! Ah, welcome, guys. So good to hear your voices.
Thank you, Trish. Thanks for having me. Thanks for having us.
Happy. Yep.
That's the whole point. Here's the patented stock first question. How did you get started? When? And why the heck are you still doing it?
After Raffoff, he's the oldest.
Who goes first, the old guy? All right.
Well, if you raised your hand, I didn't see it.
I started because I had an older brother who got me born in the next semester, got sick. And we walked by a Ford dealership in Philadelphia, and there was a Ford GT Mark III road car in the window. And my mother kept going to the grocery store and lost the two of us as we plastered ourselves against the window. But we were already pretty plugged into Ford GTs and P4s and Chaparrals and Formula One in the 60s and kind of just went from there. And he went on to become an engineer at IBM, and I went along, and we both went to SCCA races in New England and Watkins Glen, and I met John Bishop and Peg Bishop and Charlie Rainville and Bob Raymond, who were pretty much the core group of the original IMSA in the early 70s while working at SCCA races, and they asked me to come help them race at a time when the politics between the SCCA and IMSA were still pretty, you know, sketchy. And I did so, and eventually worked my way through college by going to races for John, and then he wouldn't let me join the company full-time until I graduated. So from 74 to 78, I did all the events, went to school, again, I graduated, and then I went to work for IMSA. And then other than 2 years in the late 90s where I worked for Jean-Pierre Moretti and the Momo team, I was been at IMSA, Grand Am, IMSA again since that time. So why am I still here? I think it's just important to realize that the thing that motivates a lot of people in this is the people, and the people that I've had the chance to work with, the hardware that I've seen develop or help develop, the people that you knock heads with from car manufacturers and competitors, all of that adds up to an experience that you just cannot have in any other industry that I'm aware of. So that's my story, and I'm sticking to it.
Well, it definitely works. And if you would, identify yourself from time to time, because not everybody knows everybody by voice. And for those that were confused, that was Mark Rappoff.
I'll go next. This is John Doonan. And first of all, again, thank you for having us. Each of us enjoys opportunities like this to tell our story, the current IMSA story, but also how we got here. And, you know, Mark touched on the history, and he and Mitch Bishop, probably the ultimate IMSA historians, and really I think it's something that I've always cherished is, you know, how did we get to where we are today, and never want to forget that. In my case, similar, I had grandfather and dad that were racing. Ironically, my grandfather was a circle track racer in the Northeast and the East Coast and midgets. And we think our drivers are brave today. I keep telling them they need to come see the Curtis Craft midget that my grandfather drove, because, it's unbelievable how far technology has come, and specifically safety. Down the road, my father had that same passion, and he was a grassroots club racer. When he was in the service out in California, he started out in some Formula Vs and then decided that he ought to always have fenders and doors and a roof around him, and started doing some sports car racing. He did some Volkswagens and a Porsche 914 for a while. But when that first RX-7 came in 1979, he and a group of friends were racing those in showroom stock in the Midwest, tracks like Road America, Blackhawk Farms, Groton, up to Brainerd on occasion. That's where I really caught the bug. Would have been that late 70s when I was old enough to really understand it. But I'm actually heading to Road America this weekend for SCCA's June Sprints, because that's a track that I really spent most of my growing up years at. I was there when I was 6 weeks old. And looking forward to being back there this weekend for a great race. And Mark touched on the fact that the relationship between SCCA and IMSA was strained at times. And honestly, without that, John Bishop may not have been tapped by Bill France to work together to establish IMSA. But we actually now enjoy a solidified relationship with SCCA, primarily in building our next generation of corner marshals and race officials, the next generation of people that Bo can teach, and and carry our sport into the next several eras. But we really put that in place about a year and a half ago to try to make sure that we have a pipeline of talent coming up down the road.
Great. Bo, you there?
I am. Hello, everybody.
Hey.
Bo Warfield here. Appreciate y'all having me. Much like these two guys, I grew up around racing. My dad had a great passion for it, for just cars in general, and then found himself in racing, SCCA locally and going to the runoffs and stuff at Road Atlanta, in the 80s and into the 90s. And, at about the same time he started racing cars, I started racing go-karts, and, I loved it. I loved everything about racing. I loved, like Mark said, the people, the community, and I just knew, driving or not, that I always wanted to be around it. But racing, you know, wasn't very big in Texas, so I knew that I needed to get out if I wanted to pursue any real opportunity. So when I was 20 years old, I moved to just north of Atlanta and started working at the Road Atlanta Driver Training Center, which years later would become the Panos Racing School. During that time, I was racing in SCCA spec racer, and then did Formula 2000, all the pro series they had back then between USAC, SCCA pro series, and Hooters actually started a series where we raced on ovals all in the South. Shortly thereafter, some success, I ended up racing Indy Lights. All this with no money, mind you. And, when I got to the end of the money trail, I just tried to figure out a way to stay involved. And I kept teaching and I kept coaching drivers and, came across so many people that, were very helpful and influential. One of which was, Chris Neifel. He and I taught together at the Mid-Ohio School. And, when he became the race director of, Champ Car in those days, coincidentally, at the same time, I became the race director for Formula 2000. And after a whopping one year of experience of officiating, Chris hired me to work alongside him at Champ Car. Whereas Trish mentioned, I was a steward for Champ Car, but also race director for many of the sports series, including Formula BMW, Atlantic, and Trans Am. And then after sort of the merger between IndyCar and Champ Car, I ended up the race director of ALMS. And then after 3 years of that, I ended up going to IndyCar for three seasons and then found myself back at home at IMSA, where I've been ever since.
It works. It works beautifully. IMSA's
so
running really well this year.
Yeah, I have something to add, which is kind of ironic after listening to John and Bo. This is Mark again. But I actually come from a family that never owned an automobile, and my mother never had a driver's license.
Oh, my.
That's not normal, I think. But anyway, that was another perhaps influential circumstance was, okay, no cars for you. I go figure out how to do it otherwise. So
my dad had some stories. My dad had some stories about my mom's driving when I was growing up, and I would guess he would prefer that she didn't have a driver's license.
My mom never got one, and my dad, when we needed a car, we rented one. Like, why have a car? So a lot of it depends on how you grow up and where you grow up. So I grew up in big cities, and the cars weren't necessarily necessary. But I just thought it was funny listening to John and Bo. Not funny, but interesting that their backgrounds, in a family sense, is people who have been passionate about it. And mine was completely different. So I got the passion somewhere else. My brother.
Somebody tell me a funny IMSA story.
What was that?
Tell me a funny IMSA story.
A funny IMSA story. How about...
There must be.
Oh, I have hundreds. So here's one that cracks people up every time. Is one year back in the days in the 70s, Al Hobert was tearing up the world in the Decon Monzas, and we were at Pocono, and we're out on the grid, and Charlie Rainville was our first competition director, chief steward, and Pocono Tower was way up on the top of the grandstands, and it was good old Bob and I down the pit lane grid and everybody getting organized. And all of a sudden, Charlie calls us on the radio and says, who you got to drive the pace car? Bob and I kind of looked at each other and went, holy crap, forgot about that. We look around and I see this guy, and he's a big guy. He's got a beard. And he, from the rear three-quarter, he looked like Rob McFarlane, who was then leading the Champion Spark Plug Series in his 200 SX Nissans who control shocks. So I ran up to him and I said, hey, would you mind driving the pace car? Oh, no, no problem. I said, well, just go up the head of the grid, get in there, and wait till I show up, and then we'll go, and I'll tell you what to do. So off we go. We get the grid set. Everybody's ready to go. Boom, I run up the car. I hop in the passenger seat, and I realize this guy is not Rob McFarlane. He is a spectator. So I coached him.
You made his day.
Started a Camel GT race with a spectator driving the pace car who I mistook for Rob McFarlane. So.
I love it.
Yeah, it's funny because I was drawing a blank and couldn't come up with a story, but Mark reminded me of a great one that I actually have not thought of in a long time. In the ALMS days, I think it was about 2008, Mika Salo was one of the drivers and driving for Risi Ferrari, I think, at the time.
Always.
And he's a great, great guy. But in the driver's meeting, Tim Mayer had put himself in as the temporary race director when I was first coming in. And there was a lot of complaints about the pace car speed, that the pace car wasn't going fast enough, and it was creating problems for the guys. And it's pretty common complaint that just comes up every now and again. And so everybody was pretty boisterous about it, pretty vocal. And this kind of went on for a moment. And Mika stood up and said, I know what the problem is with the pace car. There's a girl driving it. And the woman that was driving the pace car at the time was Tim Mayer's wife. And I think everybody in the driver's meeting knew that but Mika Salo, because everybody just died laughing. It was absolutely hysterical.
Be good, too, yeah.
Well, did you get a new pace car driver?
Uh-huh. I'm going to carry on with pace cars. There's one that's a little bit later, but Bo may remember this. It was at what is now WeatherTech Raceway Laguna Seca. It was Mazda Raceway Laguna Seca at the time. We did our season finale out there, and it was a four-hour daylight into darkness event. And at one point during the race, it was a full course caution, and the pace car went out, also driven by Patty Hughes, the mayor at the time, and had the field picked up. And over the radio, we hear backup pace car, please prepare to take over the field, because fortunately it was up top by the corkscrew, but Patty ran out of gas in the primary pace car and was able to coast down the hill into the little entrance at turn 10. The field took over, and the backup pace car took over the field at turn one. So it's another pace car story. We got lots of those.
We'll throw another one if you got lots of them. That's funny. You don't expect it to run out of gas, though, do you?
Definitely not. Well, we're supposed to have people for that.
Yeah, we've had cautions, though, at Daytona for hours because of rain and flooding and fog and things like that. And, you know, we've done hot pit stops at the Union gas station when Patty Moise was driving and had to go to the bathroom after, like, 2.5 hours and get fuel. And so there's a lot of stories like that that go on behind the scenes that nobody ever really knows, that I don't know that they're necessarily funny, but it just shows you how creative and sometimes intuitive people that run the races are to figure out how to get through those issues, and really nobody knows about it until 10 years later when people like us tell the stories. But
that's why we have these shows, right?
Hate to say, John, it goes on all the time and still does today to some extent, but we get through it, you know.
Have you ever seen a pace car spin out?
Oh, yeah, we've done that. We threw a rod out of the side on one of Humpy Wheeler's Charlotte cars. We also ran over debris at Daytona in one of their Firebirds and ripped the oil pan off of that one. We haven't ever, I recall, crashed one, but we, you know, there's still time for that too. But, you know, those things are driven hard and, you know, an instrumental tool to the way we run races today, and the people that drive them do take care of them. But a lot of weird things happen for sure.
I got a question. Are we ever going to have another IROC series?
It's a good question. You know, they ran with IPSTA quite a bit. Jay Signori's a good friend of mine. And they ran quite a bit in the Camaro GM days after the first year of the Porsches. They ran a number of times with us at Daytona, at Ohio. And it was really kind of entertaining that we'll get together and do that. I just don't know if in today's environment, John might have some better insight on it, and neither Bo, too. The drivers relish that opportunity as perhaps they did 10 or 20 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, actually.
Well, why they wouldn't? John, what would it take to convince you?
I mean, I'd be lying if I said that that hasn't crossed my mind as an opportunity. In my previous life at Mazda, I always thought the MX-5 Cup cars created a relatively low-cost platform. And so jury's out, but I'd love to see us do that someday. I think the number of drivers that cross over different disciplines from, you know, sports car drivers doing some NASCAR events, from the number of drivers that we have at events like the Rolex 24, 12 Hours of Sebring, Petite, that get the opportunity to come join us from different disciplines. It frankly is time to reignite something like that. So let us work on it, but I'd love to see it. I'm a big IROC fan from the Porsche days and the Camaro days, like Mark said. I hung on the fence watching those drivers and particularly those 911 RSRs, those cars.
Oh yeah,
gets my heartbeat
that
up.
That was my favorite too. I like Camaros, but I was disappointed that was the next one up.
Yeah, that little fleet of Porsche Carreras was like the first major steroid injection into IMSA, because those cars became the RSRs of 74 and later that ran for years. But a lot of those cars that ran in IPSA in the 70s were indeed those same cars from the IROC series. You could scrape the paint away and figure out which one it was by what the last layer of paint was, you know, color-wise. So,
yeah.
Great.
Janet,
it's an interesting question about IROC, because I look at it from what we do behind the scenes now to put on one of our events, and I can't even imagine the effort and the coordination behind the scenes for them to put a group of drivers from all over the world to come and compete in that. It would be phenomenal to recreate something similar.
Be too much work or not enough work or just right?
I mean, I think it would be worth it if you got the right group of guys together. Right group of drivers, I should say, together.
Well, I'll send you my recommendations by email, okay?
Yeah, I'll bet we'd get all kinds of input. And that by itself would be entertaining.
Oh, my goodness. From an IMSA point of view, tell me some of your favorites. The tracks, the events, IMSA history, track food. What do you like? Dead air.
Okay.
I'm pretty partial myself to Sebring. We were telling a little bit of a story when we first came on, before we came on the air. One of the first professional races that I went to was the 1985 12 hours of Sebring. My dad had managed to find a ride in the very first ever Firestone Firehawk race, which now today I would say is the Michelin Pilot Championship. And so it was quite an event for us. My dad actually managed to win the first ever Firehawk race in the touring class in a Toyota MR2. So it's just a ton of history there, and being there the first time and actually managing to win the race, my dad always talks about going back to that race. So I have great memories there. You know, it was the first IMSA race I ever went to, so Sebring is high on my list.
Love it.
Since I spent so much time at Road America growing up, that place will always hold a special place in my heart. But I think, you know, when I look back at IMSA history, and Mark is such a critical part of this, the variety of places that IMSA went that I got to see, you know, the temporary circuit in Columbus is one that sticks in my mind, where, you know, IMSA brought the product right to downtown venues like that. There's many others like that, but you can't forget the IMSA races on Monday at Lime Rock on Memorial Day weekend, and so
right.
many other unique places like that.
Yeah, I'll chime in, John, and say that there's a period of time there in the 80s where literally 30% of the schedule was endurance races, 30% was sprint on traditional tracks, and 30% was on street tracks. And it was actually quite an exciting time because the diversity of the circuits made the challenge of winning it all actually extremely difficult, not just for the drivers, but for the type of cars that you had to have that could handle all that. Track-wise, for me, I've always been partial. My home track's probably Lime Rock because I grew up in Northeast, but I've always been partial to Daytona because it's uniqueness in the world for a site to run the kind of races that have run there on sports cars, and the fact that it was an integral part of the initial design of the facility to have a road course. Bill Frantz Sr. had tremendous vision. And the other one that I kind of miss, and I know Dave and other people from out west will shed a tear, but I think Riverside was always one of my favorites. More so than the current West Coast events, because it was a big boy racetrack. It was fast. It was in the right place. Everything about it kind of sizzled out there for Southern California. It was the Southern California racetrack, if not all of California, but great place. And sad to see it go away. But
yeah, everybody misses it. Who has the best food?
Road America.
Yeah.
Sorry, John.
Road America.
I
agree.
Yeah.
I knew y'all would say that unequivocally. That's what everybody says.
You should ask who has the worst.
Huh? Who has the worst? I can tell you who's got the worst. No, but you tell me who you think has the worst.
Unfortunately, there's a lot of places on the same plane there at the bottom of the list, but I don't have a particular one that's worse than the other. It's just the really good ones stick out, and certainly Road America is that.
Oh, yeah. I wish Road Atlanta's was better, but I get used to it. Well, I bring my own. I'm going to take that.
Some of these places have been bad for 40 years, so it's not like there's a trend or anything. They've been bad, and they've stayed bad. So food has never been the best thing at race, I hate to say.
The best ones are when the neighborhoods, the churches, the women's clubs, all this stuff get together, and they bring home cooking to the place, and Road America does that. Okay, I got to do a station identification here.
We got a comment.
Uh-huh.
That time.
Yeah.
Talking about food, someone says, I'm not sure who is, but says, you know, the food was really great in New Orleans and San Antonio and Houston and some of these places, Dallas, but the racetracks are always terrible. So you got to separate good food from bad racetracks.
Hmm. That doesn't say much for Coda, does it? Come on. Interesting. All of our shows are recorded, and you can listen to them forever on the Racing History Project website, www.racinghistoryproject.com, on www.archive.org, and now on iHeartRadio, Spotify, and Amazon. That's my station identification. check out the Racing History Project to see what broadcasts that you've missed. Okay. All right. If you're going to talk about pace cars, what's your wildest rental car experience? Or do you have limos?
I don't know if we want to admit to those.
Well, that's why we're here.
Oh, okay. Like confession. Huh? I'll say the wildest was when Grand Am got going and we got sort of integrated into NASCAR's risk management program and insurance and all that sort of stuff. I can remember getting smacked by a little old lady in Barber who hit the back of my rental car with an LTD. About totaled the back end of the car. She got out of the car, and she walked to the front, looked at her LTD, which barely had a scratch on it, and actually it was a Crown Vic, yeah. And the back of my Taurus looked like a piece of aluminum foil. She got back in her car, and she drove away, left me there. So I had to call the cops to make her report because I got clobbered, and the cops said, oh, yeah, they do it all the time around here. They got these old cars, and they just wipe you out. That's not the end of the story, so I had to call our risk management person and kind of sheepishly said, hey, I got a damaged rental car, and I'm going to take it back to the airport, and I need to know what to do. And she goes, oh, don't worry about it. We get six or seven of those from NASCAR every weekend. And I go, great. I didn't feel as bad after that.
At least you didn't get banned from Hertz like some people do.
No. I haven't done that yet.
Not yet.
I haven't put any swimming pool, anything like that, like crazy people used to do. But
well, because you were in positions of authority, you really didn't get to be as crazy as some people do. That makes sense.
That's true. Yeah, we don't do.
Bo, that. I know you've got a rental car story in you.
You know, the only one that I can think of, I was slightly disconnected from, but there was a situation with our Formula 2000 group at Mid-Ohio in the probably late 90s. And I won't mention any of the names, but the car was returned basically broken in half. And actually, the incident where the car was significantly damaged happened just behind the hotel where we stay now. There's a massive hill there that one of the drivers decided to come down and try to make this jump, and it didn't end well.
Tried to jump off that hill?
Yeah, tried to jump off the big hill, basically in Belleville behind the Comfort Inn. There's a huge hill that goes up to a golf course there, and there's kind of a ledge on it where there's a restaurant now, and that made evidently a pretty enticing jump for these guys, and it was a bad scene from what I recall.
Did anybody get hurt?
Nothing life threatening.
Nothing badly enough, huh?
Oh my God!
Yeah, and I think that from what I recall, the police that were present were more interested in these individuals leaving the area and getting back to the airport and leaving the state than there were any medical attention.
I'm trying to guess what state that might have been.
Mine are all relatively boring. Had a late night delayed flight into Orlando heading to Daytona with a Rolex, and had a flat tire about halfway. There's not a lot of light out there, as Mark and I can attest to, living over in Daytona Beach. Probably my only one that can even crack a smile or make you laugh is we were fortunate in my final year at Mazda to finally get our first victory at the Watkins Glen 6 hour. And after the race, we stayed and had a really nice meal with the team. And by the time we were leaving the circuit, it was, of course, pitch black, and I went to find my car, and the team had taken it and hit it all the way out in the corner of the grass lot by registration. So that did not tell me where it was, but I ended up finding it probably about 90 minutes later after walking the property.
Wow. What else you got going on?
Let's talk about race cars.
Let's do.
What's everybody's favorite IMSA car? Or favorites, because you can't just have one. For me, this is Mark. You know, my tenure has given me the opportunity and the, you know, pleasure of seeing a lot of great hardware over 40-some-odd years be developed, be raced, and massaged and made better and everything else. But there was two cars from two decades that, to me, not only were spectacular in what they were, but they were significant in IMSA's history, and they are the Porsche 962 and the Ferrari 333 SP. So those are my two probably favorite cars out of a list of 20. I mean, I'm partial to big Greenwood Corvettes and things like that from the 70s
yeah.
as well. But I think there are certain cars in IMSA's history. We talked a little bit about the Carreras from the IROC series that really helped make IMSA what it was in that time frame, which is all that thread, as John mentioned as well, to where we are today and how we got there. And I could tell everybody with absolute honesty, a brand new 3-liter Porsche RSR in 1974 cost $23,000. And the used ones from the IROC series, which were slightly different, had to be upgraded in some areas from 73 to 74, were actually less. But cars like that made a significant impact in IMSA as a business, in the type of racing in the United States. And, you know, there are many more, obviously, but there's certain cars like that for me are special because they really created a whole sort of leapfrogging ahead to a different place that IMSA hadn't been before. And I've always been very grateful to have the opportunity to work with the people that made them and ran them and that sort of stuff. So
but you like the 962s, but the 935s put them where they were.
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, the Carreras, Porsche Carreras of the early 70s became the 935s, and then the GTX versions of those really became rear-engine GTP cars. So there's a thread
right.
that goes on up to today. You know, there's elements of the cars we run now and elements of the cars we will debut in 2023 that you could trace all the way back to 30 years ago, 35 years ago.
Uh-huh.
And I think that's pretty good. So we always had in IMSA racing this incredible diversity of technology, of just what stuff looked like, what it sounded like. The whole sensory experience of motor racing was sort of exemplified by what we did. Everything from, you know, John will appreciate the original RX2 and RX3 rotary RS cars, little sedans like that, AMC Spirits, just all kinds of stuff were actually raced and raced well. Bo's Point, you know, winning Firehawk races in basically a stock MR2. So, you know, IMSA's just covered so much ground when it comes to cars, it's hard to pick favorites. But there's certain ones that really gave IMSA a shot in the arm, no question.
Was Moretti's the first 333?
No, actually, his was chassis number two. Andy
okay.
Evans, Road Atlanta, Andy Evans had chassis one and three, or actually the original car was wrecked at the Maranello testing by Mauro Baldi.
Boy.
One, two, and three Atlanta were the Eurosport cars, which were Evans's cars eventually, and then Moretti had chassis number two, that first one, first year.
Well, we really needed the infusion of Ferrari at the time.
It was the perfect package, you know, the next IMSA book, which is the 90s, coming out hopefully by the end of the year, covers that and how that was conceived and how that idea came about for those kind of cars to replace what was then a decade's worth of GTP cars and just an essentially different economy, different need, and a different kind of product was needed for a different sponsor. And the Ferrari and the Riley and Scott Mark III were the two signature cars that ultimately today When the FIA and the ACO finally adopted them, they had to change the name because they didn't like our name, and it became what became LMP1 is really an IMSA WSC car. And the first ones were indeed IMSA chassis, IMSA cars. So, you know, we had a lot of influence up there with those kind of cars. But the Ferrari was magic. There's no question about it. Magic.
I think when you start a conversation about the history of IMSA and the cars, 962 is probably the highest rated, the one that invokes the most emotion. And for me, in those days, watching all the guys race those 962s was just amazing. But at the same time, and Trish, you and I sort of mentioned this yesterday, one guy that really stuck out in my mind was always in that era was Bob Trulius.
Yeah.
Group 44 Jags. Those things were just amazing. And watching how they competed and how they raced and those guys at that time was amazing. But for me, I go back, the first race car I ever saw was watching the movie Le Mans as a little kid sitting in the living room at home. And so the 917 for me is just absolutely legendary. So then fast forward in my life, I'm fortunate enough to every once in a while sneak off in a corner at a racetrack and go smoke a cigar with Mark Raffoff and Alvin Springer and listen to Alvin tell stories about developing the cars in those days and everything that went into it and his engine building and all the effort. Great stories and amazing era of racing.
Yeah, I think for me, Mark hit the nail on the head. Bo did as well. You know, 962. Bo took the words out of my mouth on the Group 44 Jaguars because Bob Tullius was a dear friend of my grandfather's, and so that was a special connection. I think Mark also mentioned like a Greenwood Corvette, and one of the things that I've tried to do in my new opportunity and role at IMSA is to go back to the real fundamental vision and the fundamental values of why IMSA was started and why it exists. And one of the things was to be able to provide a low cost or a efficient cost opportunity for people to go racing. And one of the things that always stuck in my mind is those independent teams that are such a thread and a foundation of IMSA even to today. But they brought their car that they raced in SECA to run the Rolex 24 or the 12 Hours of Sebring or the race that came to their town. And that sticks in my mind because, you know, that's the same spirit that we try to operate IMSA on today is, of course, the costs are all relative, but we should provide opportunities for people to go racing at their level. So when that, you know, stray Corvette or that Datsun 240Z or that Mazda showed up at an IMSA race to compete, that was special. And that stuck in my mind as a young kid. Yes, the big teams, the big factory cars or the customer cars of Porsche and others, those got a lot of fame. But I always appreciated when a couple of buddies said, hey, let's go run the 500-mile race at Road America, or let's put together a group and go tackle the 24 with all the big pros. That still sticks in my mind. But as everybody knows, we're coming 2023 and whole new platform, a new chapter, but it's also a little bit of a back to the future. We're going to bring GTP back, and we are so excited about that. And the manufacturers have responded in big numbers. The racing and the cars are going to be both exciting and beautiful. The cars are stunning for those who've had a chance to see the pictures.
Did anybody like the Nissan GTP?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, of course. You know, every one of those cars, and I don't want to,
there were a bunch of them.
Yeah, they were great cars. It took years for those guys to get it to work right, but once it did, it never quit working right. You know, Gurney's Eagle Toyotas, same thing.
Uh-huh.
But you had the Ford Probe, which was probably one of the most innovative cars of the 80s, was also very beautiful. The Jags, not just Tullius's, but the Waukesha cars, the 9, 10, 12, 14, 16, that whole series. Funny little story there. Tony Dow and Tom Waukesha were chatting one day, and they made a comment that Davy Jones was the only individual that they've ever hired that actually wrecked one of every model of car they ever had. So between Road America, Limelight, crashed one of everything, at least once, bad, and walked away from all of them, thank God. But a little side story. But, you know, all that stuff, Nissan, Toyota, having, you know, the Mazdas, the last Mazda GTP car, it was a beautiful car. It just never got to its full potential. Good podium car out of the box, but it had some ways to go. But, you know, that stuff was spectacular, you know. It was great.
792?
Yeah, and when you look at them today, they still look kind of cool, don't they?
Well, I see one every day at work. We're restoring the mystery number 3 car that disappeared.
Yeah.
That was never raised.
Excellent.
It belongs to a gentleman who lives outside of the country. They've been working on it for a year and a half. And they cranked that puppy up today, and it shook the whole building.
There you go.
It's on its way to a dyno any day now.
Yeah, excellent.
It sure is 30.
But, you know, to John's point, too, and to Bo's points, too, the fact that IMSA always provided a place for the little guy to enjoy the experience at a reasonable level. You know, racing has never been cheap, but we've always tried to keep that open door so that local guy could come and be part of the community, be part of the event, and be part of the show. And that's where things like the RS cars that ran on Street Tires, Firestone, Firehawk, you know, lots of stuff that IMSA did underneath the top class of the Camel GT or the Exxon World Sports Cars or whichever, you know, that's the place that really IMSA's foundation exists. And the number of people that came up from, you know, racing an AMC Gremlin in 1974 to winning Daytona 7 or 8 times in GTU, like an Amos Johnson or a Roger Mandeville or guys like that, is really a true testament to IMSA's ability to have the private little guy not just enjoy the experience, but create a business and a life around motor racing, which I think until IMSA came along really wasn't an option in sports car racing. So there are still people like Joe Vardy who, I remember his first race at IMSA was the finale in 1974, and here he is today still in our paddock and a very important part of our paddock. So there's a lot of people that have been with us for a long time at various levels successfully.
So what are we going to love next? We've got some new stuff coming up.
Well, to John's point, the new GTP cars, if you haven't seen the pictures, go online and look at them. They are truly beautiful, spectacular.
Right.
So great.
And you mentioned the Nissans. Oh, sorry. Trish mentioned the Nissans and the Toyotas, and you know the 962 was such a foundational car in that GTP era, but you know we transitioned there where the Corvette GTP car came. And then, of course, real close to that, Diefendorf brought the first version of the Nissan GTP car. Those cars were the next era of GTP, and to see the manufacturers that came, that was a little bit ahead of its time in terms of where we are today with reinventing through, I'd say, the Corvette DP and Grand Am, then, of course, DPI, and what we've known since 2017, and now where we're headed with GTP. Just giving the opportunity for the manufacturers to put their styling cues into these prototypes. I think a GTP car is the ultimate expression of a brand. It's got styling. It's got the engine of choice by the manufacturer, and it's likely the fastest vehicle that a manufacturer could ever dream of building. So that, for me, is what makes it extremely special to have GTP back.
I'm excited about that. So this is.
And I got a quick.
Okay.
Which actually a question I have also. What do you see, both to John and everybody else, I suppose, what do you see coming along as an entry-level series, something like the old RS series or Firehawk, anything in the works?
I think, well, it's a single-make championship, something like the Mazda MX-5 Cup is definitely our lowest point of financial entry. Where things have trended with manufacturer-built race cars like GT4 and TCR being our first sort of multi-class racing opportunity, that's also the lowest point of entry in that type of racing. But it's all relative because it's not cheap to run a full season in Michelin Pilot Challenge.
I think, Dave, another comment, since we go back many years to your days racing, is that the cars today are so complicated that a lot of the little guys just don't have the wherewithal and the technology to work on them and to get them to do what they need to do on the racetrack, because the electronics and the way they're made today, it's not the same. So at each era, you know, the Firehawk series was unique for what it was in its time, and it was probably the single most successful road racing series ever in the United States by numbers because of that entry access ability. But you just can't do that anymore with the cars today. So the spec cars we have, or the single make.
Credit to Mark. Huge credit to Mark, where in those eras, the cars were being, it's devaluing it to use this term, but they were home built. You know, some folks could take a car and put a cage in it and go racing. Well, that created such imbalance, I would say, because there was a lot of creative rule interpretations in those cars. Now, even today with BOP, it's very difficult to do it with cars that are all made to the same specification based on a manufacturer's homologation. So it's very tricky today, but credit to Mark and Bo and his dad in those early days where they're building cars, essentially in somebody's garage to go racing, which is not happening as much in IMSA as it once did.
Yeah, in those days, John and Bo, people, they would crash them on a test day, go out to the dealer and buy another one and build another one that night at the racetrack, you know, that you could do that. And you just can't do that anymore today. So that is a problem, if you want to call it a problem, but it's just the natural evolution of the automobile, I guess.
And back to rental cars, you wanted to make sure you didn't have a rental car version of a car that was racing because it might be poached for parts. Right, Mark?
I have heard those stories.
Windshields, bumpers, lights, anything that could be used was taken off to something in the parking lot for sure. But I think what we've always tried to do, and to John's point with MX-5 and some of the other single make, is to provide that entry-level opportunity and still a fairly reasonable economic and technological scaling all the way up to what would be the 2023 GTP car, which is a very technically advanced car. But we've always tried to keep that place, and that was one of John's philosophies in the very beginning, the place for the little guy to come be part of the show, you know. And I think we still have that today with today's equipment or today's cars.
I think it's very difficult for a casual fan to understand what goes into creating a formula, creating a platform for the manufacturers to come and compete. But then you sort of move aside from like the factory programs or the factory supported programs at least, and you have customer programs. You have somebody like John Church that can go out and buy a race car and put a couple of good drivers in it and compete. I believe they won the 12 Hours of Sebring last year as basically the little guy. So, it's very attainable. And, you know, just I'm a small piece of what IMSA does, but when you look at what goes on behind the scenes and efforts from guys like Mark that work every day to put this formula together to create these new cars, I mean, for the last 8 years now, we're on our third generation. We're coming up on our third generation of prototypes. And you look at some other series that are competing with basically a spec platform that haven't even changed cars in that same time period. It's pretty astonishing, really, when you think about it.
I'm excited about it.
Yeah, I'd just like to add a point on that. That nowadays, 40 years ago, two or three people would sit down, John, Roger Bailey, and myself, and Charlie Rainville. We'd sit around in the office in Connecticut and kind of think up stuff. And we always thought up stuff as what we wanted it to be like at the end, and then kind of figured out how to get there by going backwards to what you had to do and what kind of rules you had to write to get to that. Well, nowadays, it's so complicated. The resources, the teamwork required in every aspect of this is quite amazing because there's so many different elements that come into play now that weren't even considered in GTP era. GTP era was fairly permissive regulation. It had to be this big, this wide, this tall. The engine had to be this size. If you turbocharged it, it was X. If it was normally aspirated, it was Y. It was pretty straightforward, and everybody was out there innovating. And Trish, you remember in the 935 days, we'd have 15 of them on the grid, and no two of them were the same. We encouraged that innovation. Well, nowadays, the technology is so complex and it's so expensive in some regards, you really can't do that anymore. So it does become more spec, and there is more time and effort put into the formulas to have them function and function well and still maintain the diversity that we have today. I mean, we have, John, you have to correct me, 15, 16 major OE car manufacturers, partners putting their product on the racetrack, and every one of them is completely different, whether it's a prototype, a GT car, a GT4 car, it doesn't matter. The diversity is still amazing when you compare it to just about any other form of the sport.
I like it. So, what's next?
Well, most immediately, we're heading to Watkins Glen next week for the Salem 6-hour. Mark, of course, is north of the border right now, taking care of our partners at Ferrari and the Ferrari Challenge event. But Watkins Glen, Bo and the team in race control are going to be busy. We've got nearly 200 race cars that will be competing from the WeatherTech Championship in the 6-hour on Sunday to a 2-hour Michelin Pilot race on Saturday, plus Porsche Carrera Cup North America, Lamborghini Super Trofeo, and Mazda MX-5 Cup. So for the fans, it's going to be an incredible show. For the drivers, it's going to be not for the faint of heart. And the paddock is going to be completely jammed. So I might take that parking spot I had out in the grass in 2019 because it's going to be hard to get in.
Love it. Perfect.
So I'll bring up something if it's acceptable to everybody, but I think everybody should realize, John mentioned his grandfather racing midgets, and I think each one of us have a little bit of a sort of a maybe a closet love of some other forms of motorsports. I know, Bo is very actively involved in karting and training younger drivers. John's got quite a collection of stuff, car stuff. We talk about Formula Fords. We talk about a lot of different things because I think what motivates us is that whole picture. And we're just really lucky to be in the environment we're in today with IMSA and the condition and leadership it has today. But I think every one of us has a little closet. I happen to like, I hate to admit it to some people, but I like motorcycle racing quite a bit. I work with the AMA Pro on flat track, and I think one of the greatest events in the world, in spite of its hazards, is the things like the TT, the Isle of Man. You know, those are great events, and we all have that little closet closet love of something else, I think. Is that not true, guys?
Absolutely.
You're absolutely right. And, you know, I wouldn't be where I am today without learning what I learned at grassroots races about how to run a proper race event. So what Bo does in race control, what, you know, our track services team do, I learned that at the grassroots level, and it has stuck with me all these years.
Perfect.
One last question from the audience here.
Okay.
To wrap things up, about some comments about where electric cars are going to fit into this.
That's a good question, too. Is that an avoidable subject?
Who's going to take the swipe at that one? I think
it was inevitable.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. I couldn't hear the question.
Yeah. Oh, sorry.
Oh, sorry. It's John.
Electric cars.
I'm sorry. Say that again. You were talking over each other.
Electric cars.
Yeah, we're doing a lot of research on that. I think the one thing to remember, and when you go to Watkins Glen or when Series comes to your area, it's the sights and sounds and smells and things that Mark talked about. We're still in the entertainment business, so whatever we do in an electric platform is going to need to be entertaining for our fans, and that's going to be the foundation of what we do. And we also say, the market will vote, and Mark's right. We have 18 automakers that run with us, and whatever we do in the electric space needs to be something that they can use to market their brand. Because in the end, we are a marketing tool for the auto industry, and we want to remain that way.
True.
I'll add to that, John, to go back to what we were talking about earlier, that's the correlation between what the industry produces and what we can creatively come up to do with it. And that's really been one of IMSA's strongest points. You know, a lot of the product that IMSA's had over 40 years, particularly well into the 90s, we kind of, like I said, sat down and decided what we wanted it to be and then figured out how to make it. And I think that still exists today, and we still probably have one of the best creative groups of people to do that, not just to make the product, but how the product is shown to the public. So if the marketplace says electric, we'll figure out a great way to use electric. If they say we're going to use turbines, we'll use turbines. If we're going to use diesels, we'll use diesel, whatever it is. I think we have the right situation and the right talent pool and the right creativity to create the right stuff for it. I just don't know necessarily personally what that might be relative to electric cars. Today's question.
I think a significant element in the regard to future formulas, you know, future platforms that people might not understand is how incredibly closely IMSA works directly with manufacturers to help really determine that. So, like Mark is saying, it's a lot about you know, what does the market demand. And IMSA works very closely with the manufacturers to ultimately determine, you know, what they want to see on track, and, you know, what engines, hybrids, electric, all that kind of stuff is always being talked about and evaluated for the sake of staying relevant and putting something close to what you could buy and drive at home on the racetrack as requested by the manufacturers that are close partners with IMSA.
Yeah, that's going to take a great deal of marketing. There's some people that are just dead set against it regardless. And, oh, well, it's like iRacing. Some folks like it, some don't. Everybody all right? Real quickly, I want to quick say happy birthday to
to Janet Upchurch. She's been a great friend to this little endeavor for quite a while now. And very appreciative of all the time that she spent with us.
Big happy birthday from all of us at IMSA, too.
Of course, happy birthday, Janet. She's a friend to all of us.
Good. I think so, too.
Way ahead of her time.
Yeah, if we're going to do anything about folks that, about different tracks, then, and we are considering that. That would be a really good way to look at it. She's had a lot of fun in it. She spent a great deal of time, and wouldn't trade that for anything. Are you getting tired?
I think Janet has left us here, unfortunately.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear that.
Janet has signed off. She was here for a while.
Oh, no. I should have done this a lot sooner.
That's good. We've had a good evening.
Okay. I imagine we're getting tired. You ready to sign off?
Sure. Appreciate the opportunity to share and appreciate everybody that follows IMSA and keep an eye on us. We got a lot of great things coming, and we can't wait to put on the next great show for you.
I think so, too.
Take care,
and,
everybody.
I was going to talk about our next show. Dave, what are we doing? Do you have a date on that one?
Yeah, I don't know what the date is. I sent it to you. I don't know what it is offhand. We'll figure it out sometime next month.
Okay. It will be about Le Mans. And the folks that have done Le Mans on a regular basis. And I think that'll be great. So, give us some time away. What